Picture this. You've just purchased a shiny new gadget or subscribed to a cutting-edge digital service. The excitement is palpable as you dive into the immersive world it offers. But what happens when it's time to move on? What about the end of this journey, the offboarding process? That's where today's guest Joe McLeod comes in. Joe is an acclaimed UX designer and a mastermind behind the concept of endeneering. He believes that a good offboarding experience is not only essential for users, but also crucial for creating a more sustainable future. So how can we, as UX designers, revolutionize the way we approach the end of a user's journey? How can we transform what is often an overlooked aspect into a powerful tool for sustainability? Get ready as we unravel the secrets of endeneering and discover how it can shape the future of user experience design.
Hello, Joe, and thank you so much for joining today to our podcast.
You're welcome. Thanks so much for inviting me along.
Yeah, I can tell we are so happy to have you here. I mean, the two of us, we met like, I think it's just 2 weeks ago at the Interaction conference in Zurich, where you gave a talk. And I can really say that highly resonated to me and highly resonated to the topic of sustainability. So
amazing. That's great to hear.
Yeah, I'm really happy to have you here. And so you were speaking, for our listeners, you were speaking about the importance of offboarding consumers and how this relates to a general in transparency we have about consumer responsibility. And when I heard your talk, I so much wanted to have you here on the podcast, because I think you have so many great insights for our users. And yeah, so once more, thank you so much for being here and speaking with us about offboarding and endeneering. And we will get back later to that.
Excellent, excellent. That's right, good.
Cool. So what we usually do before we dive into a topic, we have something that we call the Sucks Friendship Book. So similar to this friendship books we had back at school. And so we have a few questions that we want to ask you to know a little bit about you. And so let's just dive in with the first I would say very typical friendship book question. Do you have any nicknames?
Well, I don't know. Maybe the bad ones I don't know about. People just call me from a distance. But the endeneering thing is a word that I developed for the course and the general theme. And now I call myself an endeneer. So I'm head of endeneering at End, which is the company I started. So I guess that's the weirdest nickname, not really nickname, but those are nicknames of being adults, isn't it? Head of endeneering, I guess.
Hey, and I love this. I love this term, though I have to say my spell check was driving me crazy. Yeah.
At the conference, the auto cue was getting it wrong. I don't know if you noticed that. That was quite interesting.
I saw that. Yeah. So where do you actually live right now?
Well, I'm British, but I live in Sweden. I've been living here for 6 years. I'm actually a Swedish citizen now. Sweden's been ever so generous for people who have left the UK and moved to Sweden before Brexit. And so the Swedes were clear-headed and thoughtful about that, like they usually are. And it's a joy to be in this country. So I love it here.
Yeah, it's wonderful. I at least go once a year to Sweden, to Malmö, to a very good conference there.
So cool. Which one?
It's the conference.
Yes, I know of it.
Yeah,
I tried to get in there, and then we were having discussions about me talking, and then it was the pandemic. So
so hopefully one day, because that's one of my favorites, definitely.
Always I'd love so to do the conference, when I had a previous life to doing endings, I used to be head of design at Us2, which is a digital company, and so they had an office in Malmö.
Yeah.
And so I used to go to Malmö quite a lot, I think once, maybe a month.
Nice.
Well, cool place.
So hopefully we can meet there this summer in August for the next conference.
Maybe.
Cool. Speaking about design, how did you get into design, actually?
Well, years ago, that was then, into design generally. I think mainly, well, maybe out of not having any other options. I'm quite dyslexic. And if you are dyslexic or on the spectrum of any what's the phrase that we call it now? That spectrum of learning difficulties it used to be called. Mm-hmm. If you were on that spectrum, then your options were quite limited. But often people would have incredible creative skills. And I was good at art and I was interested in design. And then I graduated and sort of doubled down in that. Had some great art teachers and inspiring design leaders when I was growing up, and started to look into design and get into it that way.
Wonderful. And speaking about, or maybe turning to a more personal question, how does a perfect day for you begin?
I think a perfect day is getting up, meeting the family at breakfast, hanging out with the family, maybe meeting some friends, hanging out with them, talking, maybe go for a walk with friends in the amazing woods and countryside that we have in Sweden. And then maybe out for a really nice meal in the evening, et cetera, et cetera. But there's not much work in that day. But if it's a perfect work day, then it's usually a mix of writing, doing interviews like this, maybe. I also do a lot of teaching at schools and colleges around endings. So I do for schools, I do a free 1-hour talk online, which is free to any universities and schools. I've done that over the pandemic all around the world, and that feels really good, giving back. I do also run courses. I charge for them in the schools, but they're normal fees. And then so doing those type of things, meeting with people, talking about endings, and trying to improve the world of consumerism.
Oh, that's really wonderful. Just have to say that. Talking about kids and young people, did you have a dream job when you were a child?
God, yeah, I think the dream job was to design aircraft, but you actually need to be really good at engineering, maths and stuff like that, and it wasn't on my radar. So like the dyslexia thing again stopped me being able to do a lot of those things. I think when I reflect, actually, I didn't realize I was dyslexic till I was in my 20s, and then I ended up having a test and getting a dyslexia teacher. And I remember them telling me most dyslexics are in prison and the second most are in art college. And I think that says a lot about the prejudice of neurodiversity in many societies. And options were limited. So engineering, military or civilian aircraft was certainly out. I also quite liked architecture, which is three-dimensional objects designing, or three-dimensional systems are really good for dyslexics because you're modeling in three dimensions a lot more than you are in a very narrative structure that we get taught in a lot of schools and stuff around how to learn.
And so speaking about that, looking from a today's perspective, are you happy about the way that you made? Because from my point of view, it's like you did a fantastic journey in your life so far, from what I know yet, right? And
well, I think my parents were really good at just encouraging us to do what we wanted to do. That sounds like they just had no responsibility. Just go out and do anything. That wasn't really what they meant, but it wasn't like you should do this and force you into doing things. I wasn't shamed into doing things that I didn't want to do. So I found my way. And I think you make confident decisions in your life. And what's that thing about saying yes? I think there is a lot of power in saying yes. So, and you learn a lot of for not beating yourself up about failure. So saying yes, learning to fail and being comfortable with that. I've got loads of failures in my life, and being comfortable with that and moving on is a real superpower. But I mean, the dyslexia thing is also a superpower. So, and your neurodiversity is a powerful insight into the world.
I cannot agree more, I think. And it's so nice to see that how you turn these things that where other people would say, okay, this is a negative side or a downside or something, turn that into a positive thing. Because I so much agree that it's so important to everything that is part of us is part of us and makes us the person we are, right?
And absolutely. And what are you going to do? You can't change it. You've got to live with it. And you've got to, I think, navigate it and encourage the strengths in it. Finding
exactly.
Strength.
Take the advantages out of it, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So much agree. And well, I'm speaking as a person running through some mental issues and burnout and things. So
right. Yeah. Also, yeah.
But I see it the same way. It's like I'm thankful for everything that happened on that path.
Yeah.
And brought me to where I am today. So
yeah.
Well, speaking out, people like us, we are working on computers a lot, but what's your favorite place away from the computer?
I think hanging out with people, like old friends. There's something very special, I think, about old friends that, like, you can have industry friends and network friends and friends of the family and stuff, but people you grow up with, I think they see you as a very different person than anyone. You won't be talking about work with old friends because they probably don't work in the same field. So yeah, I think that's really good. I don't get to do that as much as I used to when I lived in the UK and lived near them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, understand. Speaking of, well, you have written two books on your own and we will get back to that later, but
yeah.
What's your favorite book of, let's say, another author?
Actually, one which was enormously influential to me when I was younger, I say younger, I think it was in my 20s, I'm now 50, but there's a book called The Act of Creation by an author called Arthur Koestler. And Arthur Koestler was quite famous for other books. He, I think, wrote The Ghost in the Machine was quite a big book. And he also wrote a book about the early astronomers, Kepler. But The Act of Creation talks about the creative act beyond people who have often celebrated for making creative acts as like designers or artists, but talks about how the act, the creative act as an insight through knowledge is happens to everyone. And it's a really interesting book. I think for the design industry, it's often very guilty of being narcissistic and only really referencing itself and thinking it's got all of the best answers. But one of its biggest failures is the ability to see how awful it is to other industries. As a, you know, if the design industry was a person, everyone would think they were such an arrogant arsehole and go and hang out with other people, I think. And I often feel that we could do a lot more in the design industry about reflecting on how we come across to others working with designers and how we engage with other groups of people. I think actually on that note, I think design thinking is a perfect example of our worst behavior because it's such an arrogant put down to it. No, we're going to do this by design thinking. And so you can't think, no one else can think here. And this is exactly the stuff that Arthur Koestler in the book Act of Creation is talking about, is that you've got to see the value of that act in all fields. And this was written in the, I think, the 50s, the 60s.
It sounds really, I don't know that book yet. I just written that down. And for our listeners, we will definitely put that into the show notes. And because that sounds like a must read. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, it's quite a heavyweight book. It's a deep philosophy book. So, but it is really worth it. It will make you think very differently about creative acts.
And well, we spoke about books now. Do you have a favorite movie?
No, I don't know if I do. I mean, There's some really rubbish ones I keep returning to just to get through an aeroplane ride or something like that. Oh, you know, I quite like watching Up in the Air when I'm traveling. I don't know if you've ever watched that with book. It's a film with who's the guy out of Ocean's 11 in it?
George Clooney. It's with George Clooney, right?
Yeah, that's right. And it's just about this guy who does endless traveling and business traveling. But the thing is it's sort of, I think, super profound on many levels. It's really high on Rotten Tomatoes. A lot of people really rate it as a film because it's so meaningful on lots of levels. And it just shows the futility of endlessly traveling and how damaging it is to your life, which is super interesting. In terms of a recent film I saw, Emily, which was about Emily Bronte, who wrote Wuthering Heights. It's a recent film, came out this year. That's a spectacular film. I didn't know really what to expect, but the cinematography, the acting in it is incredible. And it's a really interesting angle on the on that family.
I don't know that one, so maybe I have to put that on the list, definitely.
Yeah.
Okay, let's turn to, well, we want to speak about sustainability, right? And there we have the Sustainable Development Goals by the UN. I don't know how familiar you are with them. So what of these goals maybe brings out the strongest passion in you? What's your favorite one?
I mean, a crude sort of way, and in a sort of also not ironic, but darkly ironic, I guess. But when I am posting stuff on Twitter, I do the sustainability goals, but I think it's number 12, which is the improving consumerism. And that's the absolutely bullseye for what I'm trying to do with engineering.
Yeah, how you And do you think there is an SDG that maybe needs more attention, that gets behind the other ones?
Well, actually, I think the consumerism one does. And I think the way we look at the problem of consumerism, for me, is one through material impact. But I really try hard in the work that I do to talk about consumerism in digital services and product sectors. We do the same, that we're having the same problems throughout all of those sectors. And it's not just about carbon, it's about the behavior that we create in the consumer life cycle. So the damage that we do in physical products, you see exactly the same problem going on with privacy being exposed in not valued in digital products. The essence is the lingering long tail of endings in consumerism, where we don't create an end in a responsible, experiential way. Mm-hmm. So what I find quite frustrating in many of the circular economy discussions is an obsession with material matter. So we talk about plastics all the time in the circular economy, or improvement in efficiencies, improving in manufacturing, and the echoing lack of conversations about the consumer in those forums I find really irresponsible. And the fact that we don't talk about consumer experience as a really powerful tool, a human-made tool that we could target onto endings, for example, mm-hmm. but we think, and I think there's a subconscious in many of those forums where you're not really allowed to talk about the power of advertising and marketing because it's seen as the real bad thing that we've done. And we must talk about the nutrients of this really good recycled material that I've made, because there's some sort of psychology going on around that, which I don't think is helpful for making the solution. Mm-hmm. And at the moment, those two industries, those two groups of people are not using the tools that their availability. And until we start doing that, I don't think we're going to get past shaming the consumer on many levels, and shaming consumers and using guilt to try and improve behavior. We know how to improve behavior, marketing and advertising have been doing it for centuries.
Yeah, that's a good point, and we will dive deeper into this later, for sure. Maybe talking about sustainability, do you have any guilt or any guilty pleasure in terms of sustainability? So let's say, I don't know, watching too much Netflix or something else or anything.
I don't know if it's watching too much Netflix. It would be flying. It would be easily flying, going on holidays, flying for work. It's just such an embedded part of the of culture all around us. And it's I think about this is so much about the experience and how we change the behavior isn't about me feeling guilty. Yeah, guilt and shame are a very old traditional method of making people feeling like they shouldn't be doing something. And it was used in religions across the world. All sorts of religions use these ones, particularly actually the ones that are the religions that have a heaven and consumer-centric target. So if you look in many religions, established religions like Muslim religion, the Christian religion, and others, there's the heaven structure presents this abundance, which is desirable, and this indulgence in this abundance. And that essentially was embedded very deeply into the psyche of many cultures around the world, that we desire things because there's this abundance in heaven and you deserve it almost. But if you look into other cultures which have, like, for instance, Shinto and Buddhism, where you have a mindset which is about understanding an indulgence and consciously rejecting that, that's when we went down these routes in the Industrial Revolution. The Industrial Revolution started in northern Europe, and it under a very clear sort of Protestant mindset and work ethic, and that particular religion has a trajectory as you go through life. Mm-hmm. Getting super deep here, aren't I? Goodness.
Yeah.
But as you go through life as a Protestant, you can't recalibrate towards death. If you're in the Catholic religion, you could often renounce sin as you go towards death. So when the Protestants arrived at death, they couldn't really do anything about it, so they had to live their entire... So you look at the end as a thing which is really difficult to handle. In the Catholic religion, you look at the end as something to be adjusted, both of which are going to a heaven, like the indulgence sort of belief structure, which is about celebrating bounty. But that environment where we built the Industrial Revolution, and then we had to build marketing and advertising to fill that industrial capacity, then we've embedded that sort of relationship with consumption into it quite sort of deeply. We now have a relationship with consumerism, which is a religious model which has been desecularized, mm-hmm. essentially. So you've removed the religious aspect out of it, but you've still got like this this trajectory towards no handling at the end, that you you indulge in the consumption, you don't deal with the end.
Yeah. Wow, we are already getting really deep, and we are just in the friendship book right now. So so you know why we like asking this question is so I think, how to say that? I think it's okay to not do everything right, because everybody of us does things that are not so good. And so I think it's important to look at how can I improve on what I am doing, because otherwise we have always these problem of, I don't know, whataboutism, right? So how can you talk about sustainability when you still take a flight to whatever, and this does not help. And I think it's important for all of us to understand, hey, it's okay to do something wrong as long as I'm trying to improve day by day, month by month, year by year. And this is, I think, for all of us, really important, right? To it's okay to fail on some things. As you said, failure is part of our life and also there. And yeah, that's why we're asking this question too.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, coming back to one of the reasons I talked about identity and measurement at the end in the conference we were both at IXDA, is the lack of capability for any of us to assess what's bad. I don't know particularly how bad I am. I have a really good feeling that I'm pretty bad as a impact on Earth, because I live in the West and, you know, we're all rich in the, not the West, but the, you know, a rich nation, and I'm fairly rich. Not in comparison to other people around me, but, you know, in world statistics. Yeah. We were in the top 5%. And therefore, you're going to consume a load more. So you're part of the problem.
Yeah.
I'm part of the problem.
Speaking about sustainability, do you have like a personal hero or maybe role model in terms of sustainability that you look up to?
Not in particular. I think also there's lots of different sectors, because I mean we've messed up so many different areas of stuff. There's a bank called Arlands Bank, which is in the center of the Baltic, Arland, which is Ireland there. There's a bank there, weirdly, that throws so much effort into doing good. And they started the project ages ago doing the Baltic Sea. I don't know if anyone knows about the Baltic Sea, but it's really dead. Years and years of people all around the Baltic dumping, not really dumping, but putting stuff on the land, which then went off into the water. There's very little oxygen as a result in the water, so it's actually a very dead sea. So they've been doing a lot of effort in trying to improve that. And there's people at Arlands Bank who have been highlighting initiatives around that. And also Arlands Bank is established the Arlands Index, which is an enormous database of products and the impact, carbon impact of those products. So which they've now turned into a product that they sell to other groups that can tell their consumers immediately, like, what's the carbon impact of this particular product. So yes. I think there's groups like that, which I, especially living here in Scandinavia, I think there's a lot more closer, we're a lot more closer to nature, maybe, I think, in a thoughtful way of that. But, yeah, and it's nice to sort of see those local projects
Sounds good. Yeah. And I love that you named this example, not a specific person. That's wonderful. Okay, well, we made it. That's the Sucks Friendship book. And we already touched some really interesting things. And so now we can take our time to dive deeper in this things. And so we are ending the friendship book, but okay. Every ending is a new beginning, right? So let's get into deep, and let's start talking about offboarding the consumer, because that's what you're so well known for, and well, your company, you already said this. I love the name and you say I've written that down. It's the world's first product ending business, as you say, and I think on the other side, there are still many people out there who haven't thought enough or maybe not at all about this topic. So maybe in a few words, could you say, why is offboarding so important? And I know we could just talk about this question for an hour, so we will dive deeper. But maybe in a few sentences, why is it important to consider offboarding more?
I guess on the highest level, we don't. And it's a massive hole in our vocabulary. So digging a bit deeper into that, as designers, we have developed vocabularies, or product creators have developed a vocabulary over centuries, which talks about the creative act, bringing something into the world. And we haven't got the vocabulary, the understanding, the tools to do the reverse of that. the end of an experience is super important for humans. We've told, for example, stories. We humans have handed down information via stories long before the printed word. So a story has a certain structure, and the ending and conclusion of that story is often the most profound, meaningful, and important aspect of the narrative. The way that we've created, and also we now create story type narratives in all sorts of aspects of our lives. So from games to movies to books, etc. The only human made narrative structure, like consumerism is a narrative structure, it doesn't care for the end of that story. So we end up in, as an experience, as consumers, that you end up in this ridiculous situation where we create these things, these multiple things, and then there's no story, no ending to that story. So we actually, I mean, one of the reasons we end up with hoarding, one of the reasons we end up with clutter, whether that's digital clutter or physical clutter, or even service clutter through subscriptions, for example, it is because we don't have a vocabulary and understanding all that discussion around the narrative structure and that having an ending in there.
That's a good, very good point. And talking about the vocabulary, I mean, you invented a new word, endineering. We already spoke about that before. And as I said, I love it, though it's a horror for spell check.
Good. Yeah, it is. And my spell check actually does it now, so it's given up trying to correct it.
How long did it take until your spell check understood that this?
Well,
that
you really needed? Actually, I only noticed it really quite recently, so I reckon it's taken 2 years.
Yeah,
okay. And it depends, obviously, on what platform you're doing it. If you put it into Google, it still wants me to look up engineering.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I will look up for that and see how long it takes for.
Yeah.
For me. So, I mean, even your second book has the name Endineering. And maybe could you, in a few sentences, we will put also that into the into the show notes. Yeah. And so I did not had the chance to read the full book, so I read a little bit through, and I have it here, and it's on my list for, because everything I read so far was so mind opening and so interesting. And so maybe could you, in a few sentences, explain what the key aspects or the key pillars of endineering are?
So the endineering book is a how-to book, really. So it's very much, if you're a practicing designer, it'll help you with practical tools of building products with an end in mind. And so in the book, you've got all sorts of aspects of rethinking the problems that you're in. So whether they be in a business level, so why should a business think about endings? If you start talking about endings at your business right now, I guarantee you'll be like, hey, we shouldn't let anyone leave our business. So don't let anyone leave. And if they leave, then it's another opportunity to sell them another thing. And so enormous amount of cultural barriers put up about endings, to the point where shocking ignorance about endings exists, laughable stuff. So there's stuff in there which will help you with those discussions. There's stuff in there which will help you think about the right transaction model to use. For example, the way that we purchase something very much creates a power relationship that you need to consider when you're thinking about the end, because the way the power relationships established will influence all through the consumer life cycle, and particularly how it ends. There's stuff in there around the psychology of endings in the consumer life cycle. So there's some starting points. There's 6 different starting points of different psychological behaviors that happen. So whether that be peak end rule, terror management theory, the types of memory and how we lay them down, how consumers seek out closure and what type of closure they seek out. That's also in the book. There's the phases of the end. So depending on regardless of whether you're in a service, digital or product sector, you need to think about the crack of doubt, that's pretty much the beginning of the phases of the end, and then right through to sort of a new dawn, a new birth of that person. And think about all of those different phases that people go through, because we, regardless of when you're often people have the misunderstanding of like, oh, we should make it a really quick ending, or they shouldn't be allowed to leave at all. Actually, you really need to think about the phases, much like you would as a creator at the beginning. Like you would say, oh, we want them to do this, then they should go here, and then we should do this, and then we should consider this. And then also there's things like the characteristics of types of endings. So broadly, there's 8 different types of endings that the consumer commonly experiences in the consumer life cycle. Each one of those has particular needs and characteristics, from a timeout type ending, for example. So 2-week holiday ends after 2 weeks, or a 3-year degree course ends after 3 years, or, for example, breakage or task event completion. These are types of endings that you need to think through those characteristics. And so there's support material around that in the book as well. And there's a whole heap more in there, which I could go on for 20 minutes, but I don't think we've got the time in the podcast. No. But yes, loads in that book. But it's a very practical book if you want to get into endings.
All good. And even for me, it's so interesting. And as you said, this, for example, to hear and to read about these different types you have, because as I said, I think so many of us haven't thought enough about these things. And when you start thinking about endings and how important they are to us, I mean, when I started preparing for today, I was thinking about TV shows, like today TV shows, like, let's say you have season 1 with 10 episodes, and there is never an end, right? That's so after episode 10, it's written in a form that you get hooked up for the next season, and it drives me furious. And so this is my mind hook to, yeah, why endings are so important.
I think TV shows are a good example, because that everything ends in some way and another. So you might not get a full timeout ending or breakage ending or full these type of things. So TV shows, they do definitely have a periodic ending in terms of like, we've made 10 episodes in this series. But the difference is that the story becomes less and less believable. So there's a thing called jump the shark, which is a phrase from, I think it was the Happy Days, when there was a shark, some sort of rubber shark that the Fonz jumped over. And people never really believed the show after that, and despite it going on for another 2 seasons. And you see that in many shows where they've gone on for too many seasons, that they've jumped the shark. And so there's a deeper thing. And why psychology is so important with endings is that you've experienced an ending, you want to leave. It doesn't matter if it goes on for another 2 seasons. And so many businesses get this wrong, because they think if the person stays, they'll be a great customer. So they stop them leaving. The person's left, emotionally they've left. They're just going to double down on their hatred for you, entrapping them. So yeah, it's well worth thinking about endings. If you value your brand equity, think about endings.
Totally. Speaking about the psychological side, and you mentioned that before, in your second book, which was your first book actually, called End, you speak about the psychological side of endings, and that over the past centuries, we as a society have lost our relationship to death, and that we distanced more and more from it, hide it away from our lives, and then you put it in relation to the endless consumerism we see today. So can you explain a little bit more about why our loss of relationship to death directly relates to our endless consumerism and with all its problems you see nowadays?
So the first book, 2017, it ends, as you mentioned, it's called Ends. And it talks about why we don't. So it's the why book. The second book, Endoneering, is the how-to book. So the first book is the why we don't book. And that helped me because years ago, I before I got involved in this stuff, I set a project at a design school about rubbish and waste, and we all went off, and then people came back with like, oh, I've made a cup with don't waste materials on it, or a pencil with like, save the planet, don't waste stuff. But in that very act, we had created more stuff that was purely essentially waste. Nobody really wanted or needed a cup saying don't waste the world on it. And this, I didn't understand at the time why that was, these things were wrong in the within the brief. I mean, they ticked a box on some crude marketing level, but I didn't understand the psychology and the sociological things that were going on for me and society at the time. So I started digging into that, and that was in 2005. I went off, done my career, but it was always something was going on in the background. I actually done a small project around then, but then I came back to it in about, I guess, 2014 or something. And then I started digging into it in a far deeper way, around death, the experience of death in a sociological sense, and also attaching that sociological experience to Northern Europe, where the Industrial Revolution happened. So it's very much because when we look at the source of the Industrial Revolution and therefore the beginning of that sort of marketing boom, then we sort of see how that gets framed from a religious and experiential, even the echoes of the plague when that arrived and the changes that we made in society around there, even those have echoes into how we related to consumerism. So the first book was incredibly important for understanding the wide ramifications of this issue around sustainability and consumerism. And I think it's a really important book, and I think I very much recommend you reading it as a background material if you're interested in sustainability, because it will change your views on so much stuff. We complain a lot about material, matter, manufacturing techniques. That is not the only thing that's going on here. We need to dig deeper, look harder at the way we think, how the way society is structured, and what our past experience is like in all sorts of levels.
True, yeah. Speaking, so we are looking from a, let's say, societal point of view right now, and maybe let's move to the individual user's point of view. Why should we as an individual, as an end user, care about endings?
So why as consumers we should care about endings? Yeah. Definitely. So I think about the course that I do and what I'm trying to achieve, I think of it about in two levels. I would like consumers to think about the end whenever they're buying something. And I would like product creators, designers, so the consumer should think, how does this end? And I want designers, product creators to think, how should this end? So as consumers, we get, I was talking earlier about the guilt and the shaming that we get as consumers. They're really unactionable, guilt and shame, because you haven't really framed what you're meant to do. You can only feel it, guilt and shame, and it's really pretty useless. And it's something we'd be dragged over from religious times, which is about, you know, getting into heaven, which you can't, you know, in practical terms, you can't do anything really about it. It's a belief system. And shaming you about your behavior as a consumer is what we've currently got in terms of our mechanisms now. So on one hand, as a consumer experience, after I've done consumption, I'm shamed and guilted. I can't do anything about that. And as manufacturers, we talk about, if only we made better materials, if only we reduced carbon, if only we'd done these type of things. But we never bridge this gap. So as a consumer, I think what we need to do is start to create consumer experiences that consumers experience at the end. So that means as a consumer, I'm not abandoned. I'm actually still tethered to the provider. So we're still a lot closer together. And we're tethered about the responsibility of neutralizing this product, service, digital product. The second thing we need to do is make sure that we've got a way to neutralize the experience. I also, as a consumer, I need to understand how bad I am. At the moment, I am removed from any impact at the end in terms of measurement and identity. So I can buy a product, have my identity attached to that through banking cards, loyalty schemes. I can be told exactly how good I am in terms of how many things I buy. But at the end of the product life cycle, I'm not told anything about that. I walk away from the carbon impact I make on a round the world airline ticket. I walk away from throwing, you know, bottles in landfill, which will last a million years or something. And then, so I walk away from that, or I'm not captured in the measurement either. So I don't know how bad I am as a consumer. Mm-hmm. And this is an enormous problem that we've got in consumerism, is I don't know how bad I am. And I think if you're going to put it down to a sentence, it's like, as a consumer, how bad am I? And solving that problem is enormous. And it doesn't mean like, oh, you've made this amount of carbon tonnage. I haven't seen a carbon ton ever. I don't know. I can't touch a carbon ton. And we use all this science material and science phrasing. So it's about making this consumer-centric at the end as well. And experience is consumer-centric as well. There's lots to do here, but those are some I think are really critical to make the end better for the consumer.
Sure. Speaking about measurements, so in your book Endeneering, you speak about, you talk about the measurement of endings, and you introduce something that you call the legacy number. You were also talking about that at the conference. And so I found that really interesting, because it was even for me, that I'm dealing a lot with sustainability, really eye-opening. So could you explain shortly how it works and why it's so important, and maybe give one or two examples that are so eye-opening, I think?
Sure. So the legacy number is something that came out of this frustration of the not a consumer-centric thing, measurement at the end. So on one hand, the measuring units that we use for the consumer are scientific, so carbon, you know, PET plastics or something like that. But what the consumer does know as a unit is how long they used it. How long was I on the flight? How long was I using this can of beans? And so with that in mind, you can think, okay, we have a unit. Then we also know what's the worst case scenario that consumer can do. In terms of throwing it away, or what's the impact on Earth in the worst case scenario. And we also know, like, maybe how long it's taken to create something. So we've got three things there, but we need a common unit, and that common unit is the time that has been experienced. So we do a bit of an equation, which is the amount of time experience divided by the amount of years, because it's often years, in landfill, for example. So a crude version of that is the baked bean can example, which I'm going to try and just look up here very quickly, because I can't remember quite the details. Got it. Right. So a can of beans, if you can open a can of beans, baked beans, Heinz baked beans, open a can of baked beans, they stay for 4 days in a refrigerator. So that's your consumer time, right? Mm-hmm. 4 days. If you chuck a can, an aluminium can, in landfill, it takes about 50 years for it to degrade. So you can take that and you can turn 50 years times 365 gives us days. So we're 8,250 days. And then you can divide that by four to give you a single number. So that's 8,250 divided by four, which is the days you were consuming this product for, I think, which is actually very generous. Then, so that gives you a number of 4,562. So that is one experience moment to 4,562 in landfill. And so you get this number and you realize in one number you can see absolutely how impactful this is, because it's a really, I've only got one moment of 4,500 of the other things where it's outside of that consumer consumption. And you can do it for other things. So a glass bottle, like even if you have a glass bottle in and it lasts a month in your home, it's about a million years in landfill. Mm-hmm. It's essentially like throwing stone away. And I often think about that in terms of all the beer bottles I threw in landfill when I shot, you know, who hasn't?
Yeah.
And that gives you like 1 to 12 million, or one experience to 12 million in as a number. And you can also do it in services, like flights, 2-hour flights, Stockholm to London, the decay of different types of gases into the atmosphere takes up to like 200 years. So that gives you a legacy number of 876,000 rather. 1 to 87. And even in digital, you can do it in cookies. Many of your listeners, I'm sure, know what a cookie is, but did you know every cookie has a cookie consent date? Everyone consents to cookies. No one ever looks up the consent date. They always have an outline consent date. And those consent dates are shockingly high. Like many of them are above 10 years. Some of them are wildly above even like a lifetime. So I see many which I can't sign up for knowingly that I'm going to die probably in 50 years or even 40 years. And then those of the other ones go way over that. I'd have to ask my kids to have multi-generational cookie consent. But some of them last like thousands of years. A good example I saw was one website, which was, I think, 1,652 years, 9,970 years. But anyway, let's just come back to the cookie one. Yeah. One of the average ones was like 15 years, super casual. I'm probably on the website for 20 minutes. Again, that I think has been generous. If I divide 20 minutes on the website to 15 years, I get a legacy number of 1 to 394,200. So if you put things into those equations, you realize actually, a plastic, you know, this type of such and such a bottle is not as impactful as this. And it's just down to the consumer experience. So I can reflect as a consumer. I know exactly how much time I consumed that for versus how long it is in something like landfill. So it's a provoking, I think, theoretical sort of number, which makes us question how we're communicating with consumers in terms of measurement.
Yeah. You know, for me, it's, you said provoking, and yeah, maybe it's a little bit provoking, but so from my experience from the, let's say, past years, I'm working in sustainability somehow. I again and again see and feel how important it is to create some sort of transparency to other people, to make things like visible to them, give them comparisons to something, right? And I think it's so important for people like us doing this, because, well, there's always there are always also the big corporates who come up with other ways of measurements. And so I just recently, someone sent me an article from Switzerland, from the NZZ, where they were speaking about how the carbon emissions of flights are calculated, and that there are different ways, and how they are compared to train rides. And if you take the, from my opinion, wrong calculation, then it's just a ratio of, I don't know, 1 to 4 or 1 to 3 or something. So, which, if you think about it, which can't be right, right? So, if so, going to let's say from Zurich to Rome by flight or by train, and so therefore, I think it's so important to have things like this to take control about what are maybe the right measurements or the most reasonable ones. Let's say maybe rather this, and therefore, I really like that calculation that you made up there. And it was eye-opening for me seeing that when you spoke about that at the conference. So
I think also a lot of the measurements that we do are about carbon. And I think it's important to reflect that actually damage gets done elsewhere. I mean, that we're in one environmental physical landscape. We walk around in it, so do other animals. But we created a digital landscape that has got is full of the same type of crap that we've made in the physical landscape. You've got to look at data lakes and the sort of stuff that we've put all together in these great big databases. Such a lot of rubbish in there, which is starts to mess up other things.
So true. I mean, talking about endings, and I think you say that somewhere as well, it's the right to be forgotten, and we have touched this sometimes today already, right? It's so important, and still, well, in the EU, we are on a pretty good way there, but not in other parts of the world. And
yeah, I'm sort of, I think it's very important, the right to be forgotten and some of the other things. I think what hasn't happened with a lot of the digital legislation around endings is, again, a way to measure that. So once somebody leaves a business, it's very hard to track if they've left that business nicely, well, you know, badly, because it becomes essentially invisible. For example, if once you've told a business to erase your data, like, how does that business tell you, prove to you that they've done that?
Exactly.
It's an impossible exercise to prove the presence of a negative space. So I think there's work to be done, I think, on other levels with but it's a really good start. I mean, so much better than it was, and but so much more to do.
Yeah, I've seen, you know, we were talking about the conference in Malmö before, and I remember I've seen a talk like 6 or 7 years ago where someone spoke about the vision of a new internet. So they were like saying, hey, if we could build a full internet blockchain base, then we could find a way to give users control over their data at every point. Wherever they are. And I found that really interesting back then. And I think that's a big problem we have nowadays, as you said, who controls the data and how should they give proof what they do with it, even if I ask them to.
That wasn't Solid, was it? The Solid proposal from Tim Berners-Lee.
No, it was not Tim Berners.
It probably was
other people,
talking,
but the idea is similar. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But really, yeah. So, but maybe, so we were touching different points of view on endings and different responsibilities. So we were talking about the responsibility we have as end users and consumers. There's also the responsibility of the corporates, of the companies, of the industry. And so how would you say, how do we make sure we balance that in the right way? So I'm thinking about, there is a story about the personal carbon footprint that was invented by BP. Well, mostly not to do good, but more to put responsibility to us, the people. So how do we balance this? Because all of us have responsibility, being it individuals or corporates, but what's the right balance there? What would you say?
Well, I think actually we beat companies up a lot on all sorts of companies in terms of sustainability. And we don't tend to provide the tools for consumers to make those informed decisions. We say like informed consumers, but really when I think about an informed consumer, it's only as far as you're informed to buy another product. And so when there's a whole bit in the book about benevolence in consumerism. So benevolence is trying to do good. Because we've created such enormously good logistical routes for consumerism, buying stuff in faraway lands and shipping it to places that don't have oranges, for example, we've also embedded things like ethics into that, then air miles or organics or all sorts of things. But that's only as far as you're buying another thing. If you are a consumer embracing the world of consumerism, then you can do good. And that's a really messed up way to think you're saving the world when you start stepping back from that. So when you look at it through the lens of endings, you see how little we do at the offboarding. Mm-hmm. There is children in faraway countries smelling different plastics with a lighter to see what type of plastic it is, because they can smell the difference in burning them. There's kids and vulnerable people in Ghana, for example, dismantling the computer you used 4 years ago, because we don't do ethics at the end of the consumer life cycle. We just ship it to countries which break it down cheaper. And they're also burning these things, no sort of protection in terms of safety and security in that. We are shipping clothes to places like Turkey and India, where all sorts of other people are paid a minimum wage to ship, to sift through all of these things. So when people do think about themselves being a good consumer, or buying a recycled product, or buying the right type of ethically sourced orange or whatever, I think the bigger problem is that we don't care once it gets to us and we consume it. We've got to start thinking about where that gets shipped off to, because it's doing way more damage than the product you purchased with all good intentions through your sort of apparent benevolence at the beginning.
Yeah, you're so right. Talking about corporates, and then maybe taking the step to business, how you, as a person working in this field for some time now, how do you convince people, potential clients, that it is important to work on the end of the customer journey? Why it is important to spend money on this? Because, you know, we as designers, we always or very often face the problem that we want to do maybe the right things, but still need to convince other stakeholders.
So, absolutely. So on the website, if you go to andend.co, there's a whole thing in there called, one of the tabs is why end? And then there's seven different reasons why it's a good business decision. So if you have a business and you're doing any sustainability stuff, making better use of your plastics, if you don't put that into the consumer life cycle and create a better ending, then you're not going to get the right plastics back. You're not going to get those products back to dismantle them in the appropriate way, or do a lot of the other sustainability initiatives. If you want to maximize sustainability, then you need to start thinking about endings and how the consumer experiences the end of your product. If you're interested in your brand and you've got a lot of passion about your brand, and you've got these brand promises like, oh, we're ethical, we're transparent, we're do all of these things. If you don't do that at the end, people actually won't care anyway, because they know you've been lying from the beginning. So I know businesses that I do examples of in the book, and they have, for example, transparency as one of their brand values. And then they recognize that they don't do that throughout the consumer life cycle to the end. So the ending is not transparent at all. And this is almost every business. But this business was clear thinking enough and honest enough to say, actually, we need to make the offboarding, the end of the consumer life cycle, transparent as well. So just on those levels. But if you've got a brand and you want people to remember it in a good way, you do a good, honest, clear thinking and courageous sort of ending that people remember in a good way. Many businesses will try to stop people. They haven't thought it through. They don't create a good ending which has good memories. Memory is the way that you build your brand equity. If you want somebody to go away from your brand and recommend it, then it doesn't matter how good the beginning or the middle is. People remember the end at least by 50% of the memory is laid down at the end of the consumer life cycle. So there's stacks and stacks of reasons why, as a business, you need to think about endings.
That's a good point. Do you have maybe one or two more examples for companies or products that implement great endings?
Yeah, I like using the Kia Cars one. So Kia Cars introduced the 7-year warranty in their cars. This is quite a while ago. And the interesting thing about 7 years is it's hard to think beyond 5 years as a human. So that becomes almost like this void, this death-like void that you sort of are getting together at the end of this product's life. And since introducing that, their market share doubled globally. There's other companies like Rapini Clothing. A lot of they make quite sort of simple T-shirts, really good T-shirts, and other cotton goods. Obviously, they source the cotton sustainably. They have loads of ethical stuff at the beginning and through the product creation process and uses. But what they do at the end is they've got a thing in their label at the end which says, send this back to us, free post, and they even give you a voucher to help that process happen. So they're really present. They don't want that product to get shipped off somewhere else to get dismantled then reprocessed into new cotton or whatever and bleached. They're going to bring it straight back to you. So that's just the consumer and the provider in that relationship. That relationship isn't falling out into society and the environment. That's just those two groups in there. And that's what we've got to do is keep those two in that relationship together with mutual responsibility for neutralizing that product.
Nice. So, speaking about endings, we slowly need to come to an end, but we have some more questions for you. So,
Okay, cool.
Yeah, maybe. So since we are designers, could you say like what can, or I would say should or must we as designers do to design better endings? So what are like the five most important things we should think about? Do you have any recommendations there for us?
Absolutely. So the first thing you've got to do is start talking about it at work. And you've got to start thinking, how does our product end? And then that will rattle out into all sorts of questions and observations about what a massive hole of ignorance your whole business has about the end. And that's after you've probably had to get over a lot of cultural barriers of people saying, we don't talk about the end here. But just starting those discussions. And it's if you want to make a meeting really uncomfortable at work, I recommend, because you're bound to be talking about this new product that you've got, and you're bound to be talking about how great it's going to be and all the users, just ask politely, how does this end? How does the consumer experience the end of this product? And you'll see paralysis crippling people in the room in terms of what they're trying to say and do. And then it's worth sort of thinking, okay, we have no responsibility of this product and how it's going to impact the world, because we're just chucking another one into the massive mass of human-made products on Earth. So that's the first step. Then start digging into it deeper. Start looking. You can the books are on. Ironically, they're on Amazon. You can bet them as real books, but you can also, obviously, many people aren't interested in Amazon. So I'm really think it's important to have an alternative to that. So the Smashword route and eBooks. I put them all on Smashwords, so you can look up both books on there,
and we will put that on the show notes.
Yeah, and then if you want to take it seriously and become an engineer, I mean, a lot of people now I chat to, people are looking for new jobs and stuff, and feeling really sick of just endlessly making things. Become an engineer; you'll have such an interesting interview at your next job interview. People are finding it really interesting and quite empowering to talk about something very different in their job interviews.
And the cool thing, speaking of becoming an engineer, besides these really great books you have written, people can also learn directly. You're offering courses in engineering.
Yeah, so if you become an engineer, it's an online course, 4 weeks, learn at your own pace. We meet up once a week on Zoom, and then we chat about the previous week's content. And then at graduation, you get a certificate saying you're an engineer. You can put it on your LinkedIn profile if you want and stuff. And I'll give you a voucher for 25% off for the engineering course for your listeners at the Sucks on the Sucks podcast. So come along and join the movement. And we're trying to create a community around here. So we've got a Slack channel and we share all sorts of aspects of endings on there. It's pretty It's super interesting.
Wonderful. And big thank you from our side for
welcome
talking this. Because as you said, I think it's so important to spread the word, and still most of us need to learn about these things and the impacts and what we can do, because I think we can do a lot, because we are the people who design all these journeys, right? And so yes. we are right at the base, actually, and we could start working on this as well. So
yeah, and that's another thing I talk about in the book, is that if you're going to build a business around putting endings into your business, where are the new jobs, where's the investment needed? So there's lots of other practical things in there. So and actually the sort of skill sets we have as designers and product creators are actually really needed at offboarding as well.
True. So coming to an end, so we always like to zoom out a little and look at UX and design and the world around it and the perspective you have to this. So looking at UX and design, what are the next steps we all need to do, or the next steps UX and design need to take, and where do you see it maybe, so us the digital UX and design people, in 10 years?
Well, I think one of the reasons I talk at these groups and things like your podcast is because I think UX community has a good skill set in terms of observing behavior, making behavior change. And I think UX also and design have an ability to see and create these offboarding experiences that we need so much. UX, I think, in a broader sense, as you say, has the responsibility of interacting with the wider environment, interacting with products, etc. So once you start looking at that, I think there's a really clear role for UX to be very active in this field.
Yeah, well said, well said. Well, speaking about the future, and where do you see yourself in 10 years?
Oh my goodness, I don't know.
That's okay as well.
Well, statistically, I'm getting older, so I could be dead. That's, I think, one of the things of looking into endings all the time is, but you've got to be super realistic about your time on Earth. So there's always that. There is always an end, and even my end might happen in the next 10 years. If I'm not doing that, I enjoy talking about endings. I think it's a really important subject, and I'm an evangelist about it. I go around, I'll speak to anyone at any place about this subject and why it's so important. So I'll probably still be doing this, and probably maybe another couple of books behind me, and different training courses, and I don't know, whatever. But yeah,
and I think that would be wonderful if you could write 1, 2, 3 more books.
Yeah.
cool. So speaking about the world, if there is one thing you could change in the world, what would that be?
I think if every country had the proportional representation method of democratic approach and the sort of Scandinavian model, I think we'd be on a much better path. The whether you're the UK or America or like more extremist despot countries which are doing horrible things to people, the proportional representation and the Scandinavian model of democratic socialism is the way to go. That's how I would do it. There's all of the groups in those regions hit all of the best, whether it's education, equality between all sorts of groups, and all sorts of investment into health and mental health and all sorts of other reasons. So that would be the thing I'd change in the world.
Yeah, wonderful. So what in these days we live right now, and with all the struggle we have maybe as society, and looking at the, I sometimes say, the battle for sustainability, what gives you hope nowadays?
The horror of it. I think what gives me hope is people are starting to see tangible horror. And I I think the more we see the horror of hurricanes, of fires, of all sorts of other things, that maybe we're a little bit closer to taking it seriously.
Well, well said. Well, and that's, we're almost there at the end. Thank you so much, Joe, actually, for joining us today and for all these wonderful and inspiring insight. I mean, I had the feeling we could talk for one or two more hours. There are so many more things. so maybe you have to return one day and we have to a second episode. And I don't know, in half a year or something. Let's see. We haven't started this concept right now, but why not? Okay. And so yeah, it was a real pleasure and an honor to have you here with us. And I want to say thank you also to all the wonderful people out there for joining us, for listening to us. And well, people out there, if you like what you hear, please give us a subscription, a rating. We would highly appreciate that. And so that's a goodbye from our side. And since the final words always belong to our guest, Joe, do you have any final words or advice to all of us?
Yeah, become an engineer.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Goodbye. Bye.
The Sucks podcast is brought to you by the Sucks Network, a non-profit initiative and network that drives sustainable and responsible UX based on the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. Hosted by Thorsten Jonas and me, Bavo Lodwex. Edited by me, Bavo. Support by Isabel Pettinato. We'll see you next time.